The Mandolin by Gene Locke. I always headed for the closet where the junk box was in Grandpa Rinkemeyer's upstairs spare room. That's where the strange musical instrument was, more or less discarded. Whose was it? How did it get here? It looked like some Middle Eastern lute-like thing, at least. There was a picture like it in Grandpa's big dictionary downstairs. Certainly in my rural Missouri family, there was no one who could name it, much less play it. It looked kind of like a mandolin, but with a more rounded watermelon bottom in pale and dark brown striped wood. It smelled of camphor. It was down to one string. Inside, a finger pick of black and turquoise bakelite, I think, clicked and rattled as in a dried gourd. The fretboard had inlaid mother of pearl, with a neck worn down by years of music. It must have had a history, but no one ever told me until I brought it to Grandpa one rainy afternoon while the rain drummed on the tin porch of his porch. Grandpa said his uncle bought it on the day old uncle sold his homestead down on Lynn Creek. The old uncle's dad had been a teamster, small t, when it meant a man who marshaled the power of oxen and mules over the Santa Fe Trail where it hooked up with Mexico. The mandolin story began in Galveston, Texas in 1835 with my great-great-grandpa. Now my own grandpa unfolded it as he and I perched on the hickory-caned porch chairs. Many years back, Gustav Rinkemeyer, a German immigrant, debarked from the New Orleans packet boat with his wife Mathilde, two children, and two trunks of all their worldly goods. This is according to the tidy shipping inventory of the Bremerhaven Germany records, now in the new Brownfels, Texas History Museum. What happened next was not written so tidily, but handed down the generations of these German immigrants. Upon arrival on the mud flats of Galveston, Gustav bought a team of oxen and a wagon. He was intent on escaping the coastal mosquitoes to travel the well-worn trail north to the Missouri, where land was almost free for the asking. English-speaking Texans in Galveston were more than willing to trade gold for a team. The problem was, the oxen knew their commands in English, not German. For this, one had to retain the services of a Schwarzer, which was a black slave whose master readily rented him out for a week so as to guide the oxen until new owner and animals spoke the same team lingo. The black boy was Lanky Askai, whose ancestors too had come by sea, but unwillingly. He jumped on the wagon's wood seat, armed with a jute tuck bag of belongings. Inside was a melon-shaped mandolin instrument, acquired from yet another teamster slave, who said he found it near a snoring Portuguese dockman. The German family walked up the hill country 3 days, aside the team, to avoid the jarring seats of the iron-shod wagon. Asagai led them to understand that the occasional white men with long rifles who crossed their path were not good news. The truth was, the local slave-owning Texan settlers did not look with favor on the northern migrating Germans who were proven to vote anti-slavery. The fewer Germans in Texas, the better. The fourth evening on the trail, as they camped by a small, scrub-fed fire, Asagai pointed to a mounted observer silhouetted in the west. Pointing first to the mounted rifleman, then to the family, and finally to himself, he picked up two pieces of firewood. He pantomimed the planting of a cross in the dirt. Gustav and Mathilde understood, though the children did not. The fire was left burning, but the family and its animal entourage moved up the steep draw under short linden trees. Gustav uncoiled a hemp rope he had bought from the steam packet's pilot. He motioned to Asagai to tie his end around one tree about 7 feet up, just uphill from the fire. Gustav did the same, 30 feet across the ascending draw. Asagai then fed the campfire, and put a flat stone upright behind it to blank the glow so it wouldn't shine uphill. In the stone shadow, they waited. In about 2 hours, two armed horsemen galloped up the draw toward the fire and their unarmed prey. Their last earthly view was of fire, shuddering tree branches, and streaking stars as the unseen rope pulled taut across chests, then snapped chins, necks, and boots skyward. Asagai and Gustav first pulled the limp bodies of the riders under the wagon cover as Mathilde comforted the heaving horses. The fire was put out, the rope recoiled, and the trail rejoined north until 2 hours before daybreak. Stopping at a ford on a rain-swollen creek, Gustav collected 7 gold coins from the dead riders' vests, then sent the bodies floating south. The two horses were set free, as if wandered from a camp. The coins he gave to Asagai. Gustav was unaware that it was almost enough to buy freedom for the boy and his mother back in Galveston. Auf Wiedersehen, said Gustav, pointing toward the way south to the boy. Gustav and Asagai both knew that a slave boy heading south after his driving task would attract little attention. Both hoped the family would be as lucky. Asagai, gold coins tightly wound in a homespun kerchief, gave Gustav the mandolin with a cheerful bow. Danke and thank you ran together as both turned, one north to Missouri, one south to freedom. Galveston tax records show that one Agnes, Negro slave about age 32, and son Asagai, age 14, were bought to freedom by William Blake, freedman blacksmith of Galveston in 1836. No further information can be found. In 1995, in the hill country near Comfort, Texas, a monument was entered into the U.S. National Registry. It honors 21 German settlers who were ambushed in the early 1800s. They were on their way to a meeting to register their disapproval of Texas' petition to become a slave-holding territory.